Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Championship weekend is here. Selection Sunday in college football is just a couple of days away. The regular season finish line is in sight. To break down what has the potential to be a really fun weekend of football and the various playoff consequences that come with it is my friend Paul Meyerberg from USA Today. There is a very simple solution to putting together the college football playoff puzzle, but we'll try to talk about some things that might make it get weird, who's in and who's out if they do. And of course, we'll take a spin on the coaching carousel. Auburn decided to get on that ride. And as always, that means a little drama and a little dysfunction. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Westwood One Podcast, Apple Podcasts, just about anywhere you like to get your podcast. If you like what you hear, give us a good review and a good rating. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast is Paul Meyerberg from USA Today, recurring guest Paul Meyerberg, and my friend Paul Meyerberg. How are you, Paul? How are you hanging in?
I'm doing well. Yeah, you know, we're getting there. We've almost made it through a regular season of college football. This season felt like it started 3 or 4 years ago. A lot has happened, but here we are. We've made it almost.
Yes, and I want to talk to you about the finish line. So Paul, I'm kind of itching to argue with someone. I don't know if we will argue, because I don't know where you stand on some of these CFP issues. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, like who makes the college football playoff is, first of all, I mean, there's a really easy way that this could all be solved this weekend, and there will be no debates. I feel like we've kind of created some debates, and I want to debate. I want somebody to disagree with me. So let's see if that happens. Let's see if I can conjure up maybe even a slightly faux embrace debate type, you know, debate on the CFP this weekend. Because again, I really do think, I mean, listen, if Clemson wins, Alabama and Ohio State win, I think it's pretty clear cut, right? Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Notre Dame, in some of that order, right? I mean, I'm not crazy on that one, right?
That's exactly what would happen, and that's exactly what is going to happen. Am I getting too far ahead in this debate?
No. Okay, you think that's exactly what's going to happen? You think Clemson will win? Yeah. Alabama will win. Ohio State will win, and we will have no drama.
No, I shouldn't. We'll talk about the game. I shouldn't have predicted that. I just feel like the way the playoff has gone so far, which has been the least complicated, smoothest, easiest playoff during the craziest season ever, it would kind of be fitting that that's the way it ended. So based on what we've seen the last 5 weeks of playoff history, it just seems like we've been building towards this moment where it's been the same top four to start, same top four to end. It's almost like the football gods are giving us one small gift amid all the anarchy.
Well, so, okay, this actually, to do this right, we have to look back a little bit, because the one, and we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, so that's before the playoff rankings come out. There will be no change in the top four. There will be no change in the top five. Where there will be a little bit of a change is with Florida, because Florida lost last week to LSU because a Florida defensive back threw a shoe. Which was funny and a fun thing to sort of talk about as, hey, the playoff race was thrown off, pun intended, by a Gator defensive back whipping a shoe 20 yards downfield. And it's fun to say that, but I don't think it's really true, because I think Florida's, like, I had a hard time really getting on board with that, because I felt like, well, no matter what Florida did against LSU, they had to beat Alabama, and they weren't going to beat Alabama. So I'm not going to say that the shoe throwing incident altered the playoff. What say you about the shoe?
Yeah, look, like I'm always a big proponent of like, don't just lose games, like lose games and have things happen to you if they're going to be negative in a historic way, at least be remembered for something. And I think throwing the shoe it immediately becomes the most famous shoe incident in the history of college football. So it's an important piece of equipment right? It's one of like six or seven larger sense piece of equipment you put on when you play this game. So clearly it's an important, indelible moment in the history of football. But I mean, you're exactly right. It takes an extreme leap in logic to say it knocked Florida out of the playoff when Alabama was going to knock Florida out of the playoff in the first 15 minutes on Saturday night. So it's disappointing for Florida. The real benefactor, maybe you'd say, would be Texas A&M, because now there's no debate about the second best team in the SEC. But yeah, it was a cool moment. Obviously disappointing for Marco Wilson and for Florida, but I thought it was amazing, and I'm glad it happened, because that's what made college football great, is the weirdness.
So I think my daughter, when I was describing the incident, the shoe incident, had a very funny line. Because as I'm describing it to my daughter and my wife over dinner, you know, obviously they're just very much befuddled, like, because it's a befuddling thing. And my daughter said, "Did he think it was the ball?" Which is kind of a crazy thing to say, but it's no more crazy than actually like pulling off a guy's shoe and throwing it 20 yards downfield. So I thought that was a pretty some keen insight from a 14-year-old non-football fan.
Yeah, for sure. Dan Mullen afterwards would have said, "I didn't know you couldn't pick up the ball and throw it 20 yards downfield. Just, I didn't know that was a penalty." So he would have found a reason to complain. My new thing with Mullen is I call him Coach Karen, because he always wants to speak to the manager if something goes wrong. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's like, "Texas A&M has fans. My French toast was cut in half. I need to speak to the manager. This coffee is a little bit cold. I didn't know you couldn't throw a shoe." Mm-hmm. So, Dan Mullen, we're looking back when we should be looking ahead. My overall thought on that game, just speaking of Florida, is that this team clearly took on the cockiness and the confidence of its head coach. And I don't want to use the word entitlement, but certainly the team expected to roll over LSU. And when push came to shove, Florida didn't have a response, and they didn't, you know, show the sort of intestinal fortitude needed to beat one of your fierce rivals. So I'm glad Florida lost, just to remove them from the debate, because clearly they're not ready as a program to play for a national championship.
How upset is Dan Mullen when he is given a paper straw at the coffee shop?
Yeah, he would like to speak to anyone. Your manager, you should be fired. You should lose your job. This is a travesty. This is America.
Dan Mullen has written letters.
He's taken to a next level.
Yeah, he's written a letter to corporate about paper straws not being being replaced or replacing plastic straws. He's absolutely written a letter to corporate.
Several misspellings. Corpa, corporate. Dear corporate. A lot of misspellings on those letters. But anyway, look, he's making a lot of money, and he's had a nice season
a
this year.
Coach. Yeah. Listen, Mullen's a very good football coach.
He needs to address that.
Okay, let's step into fantasy land for a second, because really all the interesting debates about the college football playoff are in sort of this fantasy world where things go majorly wrong, like, for example, Alabama not hammering Florida into dust. So I think that's going to happen, because Alabama is a monster right now. But let's just see. Here's the other reason why I didn't think the shoe thing was that big a deal. Because Alabama is such a monster, and let's step into fantasy world for a second and say that Florida beats Alabama. Like, I actually think that they might make it anyway if they beat Alabama. Like, I think beating Alabama could be such a monumental event that could be enough, especially with Ohio State only playing six games, and we'll get into that in a second. Like, and we're such prisoners of the moment in general. Like, you know, listen, there was a time in the playoff when Ohio State was out, and then Ohio State beat Wisconsin as if, you know, like we had never seen a championship game go down. What, 49-0, 52-0 it was back in 2014. And it completely changed the complexion of everything. And the committee was like, "Well, that's how can we leave that team out?" And they put Ohio State in. I could almost see a scenario where if Florida wins, they will be so impressed by the beating of this monster Alabama team that the whole shoe incident, well, they'll say, "Well, listen, Florida lost two games and last minute field goals That's, you know, they're still one of the top five teams, top four teams in the country.
I think you need Ohio State to lose for that to happen. Mm-hmm. For that even to open up. Let's just go with Ohio State winning, which I think most people assume is a pretty safe bet. Ohio State's been playing for this moment for 11 months. I don't think they're going to slip up at this point. If Ohio State wins, I mean, I really think this, and maybe there are unrealistic scenarios that could befall each team. Like you said, Florida winning by 30 or Clemson winning by 49. I don't think either one of those are realistic. So I think Alabama or Notre Dame are in, period. I mean, they're just in. They're in barring, you know, getting put on probation by Sunday, both of those teams. I don't really think there's a realistic scenario that could occur that would knock either one of them out. Could you see two SEC teams in the field with a Florida win and an Ohio State loss? Yeah, I do. But I don't know if that means Notre Dame is out. I just think you swap Ohio State for Florida. The winner of Notre Dame-Clemson goes to number one. You have Clemson and or number two versus number three Alabama or number three Florida, and then Alabama slots in at number four. I think we're trying to create drama here.
Yes,
when
we are.
This
doing.
Is really not that dramatic.
No.
I don't think there's really any drama. I think you're locked in with two teams. You're locked in with Clemson with a win. You're locked in with Ohio State with a win. If Notre Dame wins, Texas A&M goes in. If Northwestern and Notre Dame wins, and then you're talking A&M. And, you know, maybe we can talk about Cincinnati. But again, that's like kind of unrealistic to me. I know the scenario is possible, but it's really not plausible at all for Ohio State and Clemson to both lose.
Well, it was especially Ohio State. It's you know, again, you never say never. We saw a shoe thrown and that cost somebody a game. But it is hard to find it's hard to embrace the idea that Northwestern team, which is really not good offensively, but, you know, quite good defensively, but really not good offensively in this day and age, that's a team that's going to beat Ohio State. An Ohio State team that, as you said, has sort of been playing all year just to get to this moment. I mean, everything has sort of been set up. I mean, quite literally set up for Ohio State to make the playoff. The Big Ten came back not directly, but to set up Ohio State to make the playoff. And the idea that they would stumble over themselves at this point with Justin Fields, it seems, again, a little outlandish.
Yeah, and I do think that, like, we just for your listeners, I think it's important to highlight something very important about the playoff. The only job for the playoff, we talk all the time about these protocols and yada, yada, conference championships, strength of schedule. That's like a little bit of window dressing. The only job for the playoff, the only thing they are told they have to do is select the four best teams. It is literally the first thing they write on the page describing the protocol, how to select the four best teams. Whatever metric they want to use, that's fine. When it comes down to it, they select the four best teams. You can talk about fair or unfair, but the committee is going to select the four best teams. So if Ohio State wins, they're in. It's already been established. They've been four the whole way through. So like if you're an A&M fan or you're a Florida fan with the win against Alabama, you can like cry and moan that your strength of schedule and your conference strength and your total wins, it's all just meaningless because they select the four best teams. And Ohio State, no matter how you value it with your eyeballs or with the stats or whatever, they are very clearly one of the four best teams in the country. So that's why there's so little debate here, is that the four best teams in the country have already been established. And if they do their job, that's the top four.
Okay, so then the one piece that makes Sunday more interesting, Selection Sunday more interesting, is if Clemson loses to Notre Dame. Because then all of a sudden, now you again, as you said, you know, you likely will simply have Texas A&M move up into the four spot. But I do think it provides a little bit of a path to like, okay, let's talk about this. Let's debate this. What if Clemson loses another very close game? Texas A&M will have no path to winning a conference. Do I want to start the conversation about, well, what about Cincinnati if they were to beat Tulsa by, 35 points? Is Texas A&M essentially like, has Texas A&M been a placeholder? Like, we want to have a little debate And I feel like we're, you know, we probably are stretching. Like, I don't want to see Texas A&M in the playoff, not because I have anything against Texas A&M, because we've already sort of seen, I always will be a little hung up on teams that don't win their conference, teams that don't even win their division. We've already seen them get blown out by Alabama. Let me try something else in here. Just for the hell of it, let me throw a different team in here to see them get scorched by Alabama. But you, it sounds like you don't think that's even – is there even a debate about who is four if Clemson loses, and is Clemson in that debate?
Yeah, they certainly are. And it, again, it's got to be 47-40 in overtime or something like that. But if they show that, again, they're one of the four best teams in the country, and Clemson has not played that great this year – relative to recent history, it's been a bit of a struggle. It's been a struggle up front. The receiving core has been adequate, but certainly average compared to the past. So I don't know what the final score would need to be to eliminate Clemson. They're obviously going to be in that debate, and I think Iowa State, if they beat Oklahoma, also in that debate. I don't think Cincinnati's got a real shot at it. I just don't. This is, the committee is so conservative, you know, it makes, I don't know, like Ted Cruz blush. This is not a group that's going to just throw Cincinnati into the top four. So it really, to me, centers on Clemson hinging on the final score, A&M at 8-1 with one really good win, and then Iowa State 9-2, two good losses, and then two very good wins against Oklahoma.
Have we fairly dismissed, well, we haven't, but the committee certainly have we fairly dismissed USC? And is there any way, you know, can you claim grievance if you're USC and you're sitting there at 6-0?
I don't think you can. And not like it seems like we're being a little bit, you know, disingenuous because Ohio State's 5-0. Mm-hmm. But the truth is USC is 5-0. They won three games in the final minute. They beat Arizona on a last second heave, and Arizona lost by 63 to Arizona State. They needed a last second touchdown to beat UCLA. It's not just that they're 5-0. It's that they're not the sort of impressive 5-0 needed like an Ohio State reputationally or just visually to get to the front of that conversation. Though we're recording this at 11:30 a.m. Eastern on Tuesday, I am fascinated by where they're going to land tonight because they were mid-teens last week. We'll see if they get to number 10 or number 9, which I guess is possible, maybe. Then it could be a little bit more interesting, but I'm not sure if you can really take them seriously, even with a win against Oregon.
Yeah, I do think they will get – I think their ultimate destination, if USC wins on Saturday, I think they're playing Oregon. But who knows? You know, that could change because it's the Pac-12, man.
Sure.
They're just rolling with it out west. So as of right now, right now it's Oregon. I'm hoping nothing befalls on the Ducks. I don't want to be flippant about that. But, you know, maybe Cal. You know, well, no, Cal's already been we've already established Cal can't play. But again,
Colorado's free.
Maybe Colorado, right? Colorado is still in the break glass in case of emergency position. So again, they're just rolling with it out west, man. So anyway, the point being that if USC is sitting at 6-0 going into the final Saturday, I do think they'll be in the top 10. And I think the only reason why that matters is you start figuring out who else is going to these big bowl games. And, you know, can Coastal Carolina squeeze into the top 11 or 12? I think it would be 11 they would probably need to maybe like earn a bid to one of these New Year's Six games. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. Frankly, it probably should if Coastal were to beat Louisiana Lafayette. I just don't think the committee is going to go there. And again, the relevance of where USC is, the Pac-12 champion is going to be in one of these games. It's contractually bound to be in one of these games. The Orange Bowl is going to take an ACC team. If it's not Clemson or Notre Dame, it will most likely be North Carolina, even if North Carolina is outside of the ranking zone that would normally get them in. So that sort of determines where the other teams that are looking for these at-large bids need to land. And again, if you really want to make a, you know, let's talk about Coastal. Looks like Georgia is going to get into one of these games. I think I'd rather see Coastal. And Georgia's looking really good, by the way. But I think I'd rather see Coastal in the Peach Bowl than Georgia.
Yeah, well, like Georgia's the team right now I think could beat Alabama. I know they played earlier this year, but so Georgia's, like you said, they're playing really, really well. Coastal, so they were 13 last week. They're going to have a really good game. I mean, they'll be roughly the same. I mean, they might actually go up to 12 because Miami will fall, but let's just say they're 12 this week. The issue is if Clemson and Notre Dame make it, then you're right. Notre Dame or North Carolina leapfrogs them. They're not in the top 12. But, I mean, if Clemson takes the ACC's automatic bid because they don't make the top four, I think Coastal's inside the top 12 because they're going to beat Louisiana team that's, you know, 18-20 in this week's rankings. They're going to be 12-0. It'd be a fascinating dilemma for the committee to, you know, what do we do here? Do we put our foot on the scale or do we accept the fact that there's two group of five teams inside the top 12? I don't know how that's going to play out, but certainly think Coastal's done enough this year to warrant it. I mean, in a year when Ohio State, USC, Northwestern, Indiana, these teams are playing 5, 6, 7 games, you got a 12-0 team, the only 12-0 team in the country. I do think that should be rewarded.
You know, the other thing to watch out for with Coastal that could affect Coastal is the Big 12 championship game. If Iowa State wins, I think Oklahoma was sitting at 10. I don't want to flip to my back screen here.
11.
They were 11. So you figure tonight, again, we're recording this on Tuesday morning. You know, even if they edge up to, because Miami lost, even if they edge up to 10, if Oklahoma were to lose the Big 12 championship game, and frankly, I don't think that's going to happen because I think Oklahoma, as always, is sort of playing the best at the end in the Big 12. But that could sort of eliminate them from being a top 12 team. And all of a sudden, you're right, I think, you know, things could shake out where all of a sudden Coastal Carolina is sitting there at 10 and voila, like they're in. As you said, you know, I don't know if the committee will be totally comfortable with that. And if, you know, Oklahoma and Iowa State play a really good game, is that enough for 3-loss Oklahoma to sort of hang around in that 11-10 range? Maybe, very, very well could be. You know, listen, Florida is probably going to take another loss here. Right. I mean, is it possible that Florida gets beaten so bad that it tumbles all the way down to 13 or 14? Again, probably not. I don't think the committee would do that. But that's sort of those are the related games that affect Coastal. If you want a little anarchy and you're a person who thinks the system is rigged, and it kind of is against these G5 teams, you know, look to the Big 12, look for maybe, again, Alabama to really hammer Florida and some of these other things that maybe all of a sudden Coastal could end up being in a New Year's Six game, which would be kind of cool. You know, again, I'm not sure if it would be great for ratings, but I think it would be kind of cool.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, look, that BYU game did huge ratings. I saw that, like, ESPNU's biggest game in years. I'm just looking at it right now. I'm not sure how many Coastal fans you have listening to your podcast. But I do think they were 13 last week. I'm trying to do the math. Miami is going to fall behind them. And then you have SC 15, Iowa 16, North Carolina 17. All three of those teams, I think the committee will have a opportunity to move ahead of Coastal after they need to, let, you know, to sneak out a win against Troy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So they could fall a spot or two this week.
Yeah.
In which case, let's just say they're 15. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. If they're 15 this week, it's they're going to be in the, I don't know. Well, I don't even know what bowls are around anymore. I know the Popeyes Bowl is gone. I tell you, this is what I was saying to my colleague Dan Wolkin the other day. It's 2020, but even if it's not, if it's 2019, 2018, if you're not going to get the whole deal, the banquet, the fete, the parade, the swag bag, and you're not going to play for the national championship, only bowl game you should go to is the Bahamas Popeyes Bowl.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And that
like, why go to, right, and that's not happening anymore. You want to go to Shreveport for Christmas? God bless you. Bless your heart. Enjoy. But otherwise, like national championship or the beach and fried chicken. That's it. Otherwise, I would not go to a game, period. You lose money anyway. What's the point?
Well, and that's what those ACC teams that have already bailed out have decided. I mean, BC was looking at a trip to DC, you know, for the bowl game that's played in Navy Stadium. I think Virginia Tech is in line, we'll get to coaches. we're expecting Virginia Tech later today to address keeping Justin Fuente. But in talking with some folks down, you know, in ACC land, like they're looking at these bowl game options and thinking, like, what are we doing? Like, I got to keep my kids here away from their families for Christmas to go to DC and play at Navy or Annapolis, play in Navy Stadium on December 28th. And well, you know, at least if it's Navy, there's a decent chance they're going to make it. But Navy's had a couple of COVID issues. The other issue, too, for some of these teams, they're looking at it going, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to get to the bowl game, but we can't control what the other team does. And if by chance our bowl game gets canceled after I just kept my kids away from their families for Christmas, like, ugh, the prospects of that are just awful. So I think the bowl games will be played, and they will be played in some sunny destinations, and there are going to be teams who are going to be excited to play in them. But so I don't think you're going to have a situation where there's, I think, 33 bowl games now, though the Frisco Bowl got canceled today. So now we're down to 32 because SMU can't play on Saturday. I think we're going to get a bunch of bowl games, but I do think that there'll be enough teams. But I think that we're going to probably have another dozen or so teams that say, or, you know, close to a dozen teams, when it's all said and done, that say no thanks.
Yeah. And obviously you'll see teams with losing records in there. It's a matter of being willing to take the chance you mentioned, you know. And I like to see these bowl games move back a little bit. I mean, or, you know, played on the 20, well, no. I like to see them move back. But then again, like, I'm thinking, oh, so they can go see their families for Christmas. But you do that, and all of a sudden, yeah, the game gets canceled. Right. So I don't really know. It's a terrible situation. I hope every school does what BC did and what Pitt did, mm-hmm. which is, like, seat your 115 guys in the biggest room you've got. And with a raise of hands, who wants to play and who doesn't? And they listen to the players, because there's nothing to be gained. What does Pitt gain from playing, you know, Georgia Southern in a you know, the Weed Eater Bowl? Nothing. So I leave it up to the players. They've been through the most.
Yeah, and they have been. And it has been a long season. So let's get back to, well, you know, we opened a window there to talk about the I'm trying to start an argument with you on the college football playoff, but there's just no argument to be had, really. It's just I want to fight somebody about letting Texas A&M in, but the fact of the matter is Texas A&M is probably going to get in. If Clemson loses, there's a good chance Texas A&M is going to get in, which will be a little disappointing.
Well, one thing that's interesting, right, is that if A&M gets in, do they automatically go to 3? And if that's the case, which team do you say, hey, I'm sorry, we don't want a rematch, you've got to play Alabama in the first round? Is it Ohio State, who stays at 4? Because the goal is to avoid a rematch if possible. But that's also ridiculously unfair to teams 2 or 3, because they are so much better than A&M and so much more accomplished. Why should they have the penalty of having to play Alabama in the first round? Just because A&M lost to Bama by 20 back in October.
Right, right. I think you'd end up with A&M still sitting there. You know, let me touch on one more thing, because there's been some reporting around it from Pete Thamel and Stuart Mandel, and I've talked to some folks about it, and it'll probably be written more about it tonight when, you know, Bill Hancock has to make an appearance on the teleconference after the rankings. And that is the idea that there's a chance the semifinal might not be played in the Rose Bowl. I'm interested to in part because of travel, the idea of traveling these teams all the way across the country, especially a team like possibly Clemson all the way across the country to be there a day and a half before the game. And of course, no fans are going to be allowed in the Rose Bowl, and not only no fans, but no family members. So that's been sort of latched onto by some folks who don't want to make that trip. Hey, I want my players to play in front of their family, which I think is a fair argument, but I also think might be a hair disingenuous. I think there's also some desire to not make that trip all the way across the country. So you could end up with a semifinal being played in Dallas instead. It would be a good short notice transition. I think we'll know more about that. Maybe even by the time you listen to this podcast, that thing will be hashed out. I think the thing I would say is what I am most curious about when it comes to that situation, Paul, is will the Big Ten, like, is this going to be decided by whether Ohio State is in position to play at the Rose Bowl? because I think a lot of the pressure is coming from the SEC and the ACC, but the Big Ten is partners with the Rose Bowl. And I don't know if the Big Ten is going to have a great desire to screw the Rose Bowl. And I'm interested to see what kind of fight the Big Ten and Pac-12 to a lesser degree, but with very little leverage, will put up for the Rose Bowl.
You know, I honestly had not thought of that point. Off the top of my head, though, my first thought is whether the Big Ten has the ammunition to do that and has the goodwill. And I mean, it's the Big Ten. I think a lot of people are overstating what kind of damage to their reputation last few months have been, certainly when you get into a room with other conference commissioners and so on down the line. But is that a fight the Big Ten wants to have? Is that a fight that they can win? And if they aren't sure that it's worth fighting for, is it a worthwhile endeavor in this environment? I don't really know. To me personally, I understand that it's super weird. Just, I don't know what other words to use, and not have a Rose Bowl. I mean, we had a Rose Bowl we moved it to the East Coast during World War II because we couldn't have lights up in Pasadena. So things have been done to hold this game annually. But if you take that out of the equation, just the history of it, it just makes too much sense to play the game in the Central Time Zone. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Minneapolis, I mean, obviously the Cotton Bowl is the obvious one, but you know, Indiana, Minneapolis, Dallas, it just makes too much sense. And I don't, other than the historical nostalgia part of it, you can't really make an argument for playing the game in Pasadena this year.
You know, the other part of it too is it's not a Rose Bowl, right? I mean, and I say that. I know
it's not, but you know what I mean.
But it is, but it's not. And I think that's whether we think that's semantics and fans maybe look at it and say, no, it is a Rose Bowl. It says it's a Rose Bowl. What I've been told is that this is a little different to the people who run the Rose Bowl. In other words, like I think that the folks out there, if they don't have their just normal Pac-12, Big Ten Rose Bowl, it's not really a Rose Bowl. Which I think makes it a little more palatable to have it moved because you're not in their minds. And remember, there's no parade this year either. For the people who really embrace and sort of run the Rose Bowl, you're not moving the Rose Bowl. You're moving a semifinal, and it's not even though it would be sad not to have a Rose Bowl. And you know, the other thing is too, it is conceivable that if that game was moved, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten could do something to play a game there. Maybe not at, you know, the 4 o'clock kickoff on New Year's Day because there are contracts that make that an exclusive window. But it is certainly possible that you could do something that looks more like a Rose Bowl as far as the matchup, but just do it on a different day. Now, again, I know that means it's not a Rose Bowl, but I'm just sort of throwing that out there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I know what you're saying about they're a weird bunch of people who are super Rose Bowl fanatics. That's like a real, like, you know, sect of college football bowl people. But I understand what you're saying. To me, as a viewer, it still qualifies as a Rose Bowl experience, and therefore, even if it's not defined as one, it is strange not to have that visual experience to see the sun go down over the mountains in the background of the Rose Bowl.
Okay, I'm a little late on my break. I want to take a quick break. You're listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I am talking with my friend, recurring guest Paul Meyerberg from USA Today, and we will be back. Talk a little coaching carousel right after this.
Hey, it's Michael Rosenbaum. You may remember me as Lex Luthor from the hit TV show Smallville. Regardless, I have this really cool podcast called Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum, where I get celebrities who are a lot more famous than me to really open up. Let's get inside of Jim Jefferies.
Oh, I never did anything with my life. I could have been a better son. Oh, God. I should apologize to this person.
So, join me on Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
We're back on the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm talking with Paul Meyerberg from USA Today about a lot. We tried to drum up an argument about the college football playoff, and neither of us have the passion to do it. It's that kind of year. We're just beaten down. Let's talk a little carousel stuff with coaches. We are, you know, it's been reported, and confirmed a lot of places that, you know, Justin Fuente is going to come back. So that's not a job at Virginia Tech. So that's a job that we expected might come open that won't. The jobs that are open, again, nothing too shocking. Illinois has, you know, gotten rid of Lovie Smith. Vanderbilt filled its coaching vacancy as of open still is Arizona. Open still is Auburn. Let's start with Auburn because I don't see, I think it was time for both parties to go in different directions. I think this is a good breakup. You know, like, you know, you have your couples that maybe you're friends with both sides of the relationship. And you sort of find yourself thinking like, I think they would be better off without each other. And you don't really know how to say that. But when they do break up, you find yourself thinking like, now I have to choose which one I'm going to be friends with. But I think in the long run, maybe they were better off without one another. I think that's the point the relationship got to with Gus Malzahn and Auburn. That I think it was probably time for them to go their separate ways. But then you throw in $22 million to do it.
It's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Okay, so here's my thoughts on this. This is just based off that we've all been through 15 of these coaching cycles. We can read tea leaves sometimes. Kevin Steele's story came out yesterday, right? Kevin Steele is Auburn's defensive coordinator. Kind of floated. That idea was floated out there publicly to gauge a reaction because I think Auburn is trying to see what sort of backup plans would be palatable. I think Clay Helton is an obvious candidate for this job if they can get him and they want to pay him that amount of money. He's a guy you can develop quarterbacks. He's originally from the region. He has an idea of what makes the SEC tick. I think that would be a pretty solid hire, in my opinion. I just don't take the Kevin Steele thing seriously because you can't, with a straight face, fire a coach who has been to a national championship and won every single season, had a winning record, pay $22 million and then hire his defensive coordinator as his replacement. You just can't do that.
Right.
Not even Auburn can do that. Right? I mean, you can't do that. That can't be a thing that actually happens in the world. It can't be.
I would agree with you that it cannot be that. It cannot be that. Like, you just can't, yeah, you can't fire someone for $22 million and then elevate a defensive coordinator who also, by the way, was a failed head coach at Baylor almost two decades ago.
Historically, historic failure. Right. We all know the UNLV story from, I think, his first game, right? I think they just had to take a knee, and instead Baylor ran
right.
The ball, fumbled, kind of like a miracle at the Meadowlands kind of thing.
Yes, from it was a Herman Edwards, scoops up the fumble deal. Yes, they did that. That's what
right.
Kevin Steele has that on his resume.
So I want him to be hired just so I want to see how the magicians in Auburn's communications department write that up in his in that press release. His stint at Baylor. I don't take it seriously because. It's not a serious proposition in my mind. If you do that and you're Auburn, it's just not a serious thing to do. Serious people with millions of dollars on the line don't make that kind of decision. I'm sorry. That cannot happen.
Okay. So we talked about Kevin Steele and how that seems like crazy. Let me go back to another thing that you just said, which I think might be crazy too. Because I actually had to stop myself and think, did he just say Clay Helton? Embattled USC coach would be the coach that Auburn then swoops in and has fired a coach for $21.5 million to hire embattled USC coach Clay Helton. Because as crazy as the Kevin Steele thing was, I was so dumbfounded by that comment that I had to go back and ask you if that was exactly what you said. Clay Helton, you think Clay Helton would be a candidate for this job?
Number one is that he went to Auburn originally. Okay, so there's a familiarity with the program to a degree. His dad grew up coaching in the SEC. There's a familiarity with the conference. He can develop quarterbacks. He has a set offense that has a proven track record of success. He has successfully recruited quarterbacks. And I think being at USC for the last 4 or 5 years of that pressure cooker has uniquely prepared him and qualified him to coach in any environment. Because USC is high pressure, period. And I think the situation that Helton has worked in and worked in admirably the last 3 or 4 years would make Auburn seem like a walk in the park. This is just me throwing a name out there. Helton is playing Saturday. There's no reason to think that on Sunday he's going to be Auburn's head coach. He's playing Friday. I just think that Clay Helton has a proven track record. He's been in major bowls. He does one thing very well, which is quarterbacks. And I think you could do a whole lot worse than Clay Helton. You could hire Kevin Steele. And I think Clay Helton would be an obvious upgrade over hiring Kevin Steele, for example, because the dude has won 45 games at USC mm-hmm. with one bad season. So let's just be realistic about who Auburn can get in this environment. And I think Clay Helton hits a lot of boxes for Auburn.
I think that they – okay, so, yeah, I get you're being hypothetical there. I do wonder if at this point it simply becomes a – it seemed a whole lot like Mario Cristobal basically sort of said without coming right out and saying last night that, like, nah, I'm good. I'm good here. So then I think it becomes kind of a Hugh Freeze thing, right? I mean, it's – does Auburn want to be the one that brings back Hugh Freeze? Is Tennessee waiting in the wings to bring back Hugh Freeze? And again, it sort of goes back to the whole, if you're going to spend $21 million to get to bring in a new head coach, like you got to get somebody that's going to get people excited. We can all talk about whether Hugh Freeze deserves a chance or not, but I think that in Auburn, that is a hire that would sell. I think that's a hire that people would say, oh yeah, this guy beat Alabama twice. He's exactly what we need. Whether that's true or not is, you know, we'll find out in the long run. But I think that's a hire that Auburn could sell as worthy of the $21
million. Yeah, no, you're right. And Auburn could sell that to themselves. I mean, they hired Bruce Pearl, right? Do I have that right? Or was he at Auburn then get hired?
No,
right.
No. Yeah. So that was his next landing spot.
Yeah, I think Auburn would sleep fine at night. And look, like that's I'm making out like Hugh Freeze is like this demon. The stuff that Hugh Freeze got pinched for and got in trouble for at Ole Miss, I think we can overlook all of it. I mean, personal mistakes, I don't think we should hold against a dude in any walk of life. And certainly as a coach, if you had fess up to your mistakes, show contrition, move forward, he's clearly a candidate. And I would hate to see the SEC say something like, oh, we're a little bit against this, because I think he's earned the right to move back into the big time. Still, I do think that you do have to sell it. You have to sell it if you're Auburn. I think they probably can sell it. I just don't know if it's realistic, you know, Hugh Freeze being in the mix for that job. I think a lot of people on the Auburn beat reported yesterday that he was not at this point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think things can change. I think saying that he's number one on the list, in other words, and that they're trying – or Cristobal one, Freeze number two – I think that might be overstating his appeal to some big time SEC programs.
That's fair. And then like the Billy Napiers come in mind. And again, it becomes, how can you sell it? But you know, again, if you think you, if there is a world in which you think you can still sell Kevin Steele, then there's really no reason why you couldn't sell Billy Napier, who's done a great job at Louisiana Lafayette. And I also, the funny thing is, so you brought up Clay Helton and I kind of made fun of you there, but I also do think that I could see this search landing in a very unpredictable spot. So that's why I'm glad you brought up somebody like Helton, because I do think that, you know, that happens a lot with some of these searches. It hasn't happened with some of the searches this year. Shane Beamer was right out of the box, a name that was very prominent, and he got the job at South Carolina. Clark Lee, everybody sort of said like, yeah, that's probably his job if he wants it at Vanderbilt. And that's exactly what happened. So these things don't always take twists and turns. But for Auburn, there is a built-in drama in their DNA. You could see this thing taking some twists and turns and landing on a guy you go, oh, I didn't really think of that one. Like that's interesting. Like when did that one pop on the radar? So keep an eye out for Auburn. They're always interesting and drama filled. There is no proof of concept that Illinois should be a lot better at football, though we all convince ourselves that Illinois should be a lot better at football. Is Illinois a classic underachiever, or are they just, this is what Illinois is?
Yeah, so that's funny. I've seen more than a few articles in the last couple of days. Illinois is a sleeping giant. Illinois must be in a coma. Because sleeping giant, it's been 100 years since Red Grange left campus, and not a lot of good things have happened in the century since. So I think that's really laughable. It's like saying, hey, Vanderbilt, they can really win a national championship if they recruit number one classes 4 or 5 years in a row and then find a great quarterback. Yeah, it's that easy. Now go ahead and do it. Illinois hasn't done it in a century, so give me a break. Vanderbilt, Illinois, Arizona to a lesser degree. History is not your friend. Being normal is not your friend. Trying to out-normal the competition is going to lead to 2-10, 3-9, 4-8. So I think Jeff Monken is and should be a candidate at all of these places because he makes you immediately different. And as I said, I think I wrote last week, everyone poo-poos the offense. There is no difference. I understand they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. There is zero difference in my mind between introducing Jeff Monken's idea for his option offense, his spread option offense, into a Power 5 league than introducing Mike Leach's air raid into a Power 5 league, because both of these offenses are the same distance removed from the norm. So yeah, you'll say that it's antiquated, it's old-fashioned. Well, I mean, Army's won 40 games in the last 5 years or whatever the number is. So it works. It's successful. So Illinois and Vanderbilt didn't necessarily do this. I think Illinois has got to dare to be different and reach outside the box and try something different, because hiring the MAC coach who's doing well, or hiring the defensive coordinator at X Power 5 school, it's just not your recipe for success. Mm-hmm. If you need evidence of that, go to google.com. Type in Illinois football by season, click on the Wikipedia link, and look at your history, because it's disgusting. So try to be different would be my advice.
Yeah, I've been sort of shilling for Lance Leipold to get the Illinois job, but I think your premise is valid. The idea that Lance Leipold is as well as he has done at Buffalo and at Wisconsin Whitewater will come in and try to sort of do what other teams in the West are doing. And there is no proof of concept that Illinois is capable of doing what everybody else does and just simply doing it better. Right.
One thing about Leipold and also about Chadwell down at Coastal. They have an identity and they have a vision for their program. Mm-hmm. And there's no shortcuts for Leipold, and you saw it at Buffalo. At the very least, like, you hire that guy, not just that he won X number of D3 national championships or he's won X number of games at Buffalo. You immediately know what your football program is about. And the crucial thing for any program, if you're not going to recruit top 10 classes and out talent people, if you're team number 30 to 70 in the country, you need to know who you are. Like, who is Purdue right now? Mm-hmm. Who is Nebraska? Who is Duke? Who are you? Like, what are you about? And you hire Leipold at Illinois, you immediately know who you're about. So it's not as quirky or as different as Monken, but it's the same idea that you immediately become something that you're not yesterday because you have direction and you have leadership. So I would love that hire as well. I think it's a similar hire to Monken. It makes you different because you become something that you can glom onto and use to move forward and build maybe a winning environment in the next 2 or 3 seasons.
Paul, I didn't get into a fight with you. We didn't argue, but I am really happy that we had a chance to catch up. It's been far too long that we've seen each other. Maybe we will catch each other in New Orleans at a semifinal, but very much as always, appreciate your insight and thanks for coming on the show, my friend.
Thank you for having me. I'll see you through some plexiglass in the Sugar Bowl press box with 20 people in the stands. I'm looking forward to it.
Happy holidays, Paul.
Thanks.
Now, 3 and out. First down. Some Heisman thoughts, because that's obviously getting decided this weekend, too. There has been a surge in support for Alabama's Devontae Smith. Receivers do not win the Heisman very often. Desmond Howard did it for Michigan in 1991. Tim Brown did it for Notre Dame in 1987. So it's been a while. It is kind of ridiculous, but that punt return Smith had last week was probably pretty helpful. The receivers who have won the Heisman have also been big contributors on returns. So having that one data point could be significant. Again, sounds laughable, one punt return, but I think it gets people to notice Smith in a different way other than just as a traditional receiver. In the most recent Athletic and ESPN straw polls of Heisman voters, Smith became number one. That's not insignificant. Here's why I think Smith won't win, though, and why the surge toward him could hurt his teammate Mac Jones. There are more than 900 Heisman voters, including former winners, and I don't think nearly enough of them are as plugged into college football to the point where Smith will be able to break the hold quarterbacks have had on the award. There has been a fairly well-established race between Jones, Kyle Trask, Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, with Ian Book from Notre Dame on the rise, and Zach Wilson from BYU falling. I'm skeptical about the vast majority of voters' ability to pivot to a receiver. The folks who work at The Athletic and ESPN are people who cover college football 24/7. That's not necessarily a representative sample of the voter pool. And I also think if Alabama blows out Florida in a way that Jones and Smith are limited in the damage that they do, the result could ultimately hurt the candidacies of Jones, Smith, and Trask and open the door for Trevor Lawrence to make a late push with a great game against Notre Dame. Second down, the ACC picked Northwestern Athletic Director Jim Phillips as their commissioner, making a move the Big Ten could have made last year. Let me be very clear. I think Kevin Warren has gotten a bit of a raw deal over the past 6 months as the Big Ten stepped on every rake possible in navigating its way through the pandemic. Warren doesn't make decisions unilaterally. His job is to execute the will of the president's consensus build and lead. Now, he hasn't done a great job of that, but starting into a new position with no experience, no institutional knowledge, no previous relationships, and then having the worst crisis to hit the industry ever is an impossible situation. The Big Ten had a safer candidate in-house in Phillips and chose to go outside the box, and in the short run, it hurt the league. We'll see what happens in the long run, though. These jobs tend to be lifetime appointments. 10 to 15 to maybe even 20 years from now, Warren's tenure at the Big Ten might look very different. But I do think it was a really good hire for the ACC. Third down. The first bowl scheduled this season is also the first bowl canceled because one of its teams was struck by COVID-19. The Frisco Bowl was set to be played Saturday. Yes, a bowl game on the same day as conference championship games. SMU was scheduled to take on UTSA, but the Mustangs had to pull out of the game. UTSA will now play in the First Responders Bowl on December 26th. I mentioned this with Paul, but we've had four ACC schools and Stanford announced they won't go bowling. A big part of it is what just happened in the Frisco Bowl. These teams are realizing that they could give up spending Christmas with their families, getting back to something that is more like a normal life outside strict COVID-19 protocols, and then the other team can't play and you have no game. For a school like BC or Stanford, which both have had remarkable success avoiding the virus this season, it just didn't make sense to take on 2 weeks of preparation for a game when you can't control how your opponent might come through it. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, Sarah McCrory, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Westwood One Podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. By the way, if you're downloading this week's podcast and thinking, hey, signing days this week, why am I not hearing anything about that? We covered that topic on last week's show with Barton Simmons and Bud Elliott from 24/7. So feel free to go back and seek that out if you missed it. Plenty of recruiting stuff in there. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening and come back for more next week. Yep, even in a holiday week, we will come back for more of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.